Hello, my name is Joanna Yeo, Senior Technical Manager at the ISV. I'm joined today by Daryl Scott, ISV member, to provide an update on the insurance contracts project. In April and May, we provided a series of webinars to discuss the forthcoming requirements in that standard. Since then, the board has discussed sweep issues, which affect the discussion provided in some of those webinars. We are taking this time to update you on the changes that have happened since those webinars. The first webinar talked about the need for change and the history of the project. At that stage, in April and May, the board had completed its redeliberations in February and had directed staff to begin drafting the forthcoming standard. Since then, we have been busy doing fieldwork with external participants. Daryl, would you like to discuss this?
Thanks, Joanna. So the fieldwork process commenced in the second half of the year, and the objective of the fieldwork was to work with a select number of individual insurance companies to get them to take the drafting as it stood at that point in time and apply that drafting within the context of their current business activities, within the current context of what they were doing. And our objective from our perspective was for us to see whether or not the words as we had written them were translating into activities as we had intended them to translate into activities. Also for us to understand whether or not there were some complications arising from the words or some ambiguities arising from the words to make sure that the words themselves were understandable in a practical, implementable environment. The fieldwork participants were a select group of companies picked from geographical diverse regions, also involved in different types of insurance, with the objective of giving us as much different feedback as possible. And I must at this stage take the opportunity to thank again those participants for an extremely diligent exercise in which they clearly applied a lot of time and effort. And the board was able to get a lot of very useful feedback from that. In addition to the areas that we had specifically targeted, we also received feedback on the operationality of some of the things that we had proposed, and in specific, as a consequence of that, considered some changes. So the next step that followed that was a meeting in November where the staff pulled together all of the views that we had heard from the field test process, brought those issues back to the board for consideration of whether or not we should consider simplifications or changes to the standard to reflect the feedback we'd received. And the board was able to pick up on a number of issues where we believed that simplifications were warranted based on that feedback, and we'll discuss a few of those further on into this presentation. It was important that the staff views were captured obviously what had been told to us by the participants in the process, but also it was important that the board agreed with the views that the staff brought to us and that we were able to progress the project from there. So where to from here? The board next discussed what the process would be, what the further steps were that were to be expected. The major step that remains in the process at this point is what we term a fatal flaw review. The fatal flaw review is a part of the ISB's due process and involves the distribution of the standard to a select number of standard setters who've been previously involved in the process, as well as audit firms and a few others, who provide us with feedback on the drafting as it is written. Primary objective there is for these fatal flaw reviewers to identify anything where they believe the standard is poorly written or is contradictory, or in particular where the standard does not reflect board decisions as they know have been taken by the board. That process has now commenced. Based on that process, the staff were comfortable to tell us that having made the decision we made in November and assuming the fatal flaw process proceeds according to plan, we would expect to be able to publish this standard in the first half of 2017. And so the board discussed as a next instance the effective date of the standard. And the board concluded an effective date of 2021. That effective date will give preparers who will be applying the standard in a period of approximately 3.5 to 3.75 years in which to implement the standard. The board believes that is relatively generous in the context of other standards that we've recently produced, but we believe that that was warranted given the extent of the change that we believe companies will need to apply in order to implement this standard. And we think and accept that there's going to be a significant number of changes to underlying systems to bring this into effect. We did discuss at the board table whether we should go for a period of even longer than 3.5 years. But the board noted that in the 2013 exposure draft process, constituents were specifically asked whether they thought 3 years would be sufficient, and in general, the feedback supported the idea of 3 years. And the board also noted the importance of getting a final standard out in the context of IFRS 4 as it stands at the moment and the diversity that exists in the practice around that standard. And so balancing these two objectives, we believe that the 3.5 year period was appropriate and adequate for what we were trying to achieve.
The next series of slides that we want to provide an update on was the webinar series number 3, initial measurement of insurance contracts, and webinar series number 4, subsequent measurement of insurance contracts. In particular, those slides discuss the level of aggregation for the initial measurement of the contractual service measurement and the subsequent measurement of the contractual service margin. Since then, the board has made decisions that alter the level of aggregation for the contractual service margin. Daryl.
Thanks, Joanna. Level of aggregation is one of those topics that as a board we have discussed on several occasions through the process of this project. And it's one that we have struggled a little bit to come to an answer that balances the various requirements that we believe are important. I think it is important to remember that in the context of IFRS generally, the focus is on the individual contract. And that is because the board has always believed that the rights and obligations are created at the individual contract level. And therefore, it is appropriate that measurement occur in that space. It is appropriate that recognition of profit occurs in that space. When we came to thinking about insurance, we needed then to ask ourselves the question as an initial starting point, why is insurance different? Why do we need to think about the process for insurance differently? And we accepted the argument that we heard from the insurance industry that because insurance is primarily a business that is involved in the aggregation of risks, the putting together of large numbers in the context of an individual contract or contract type, aggregation and reporting on an aggregated basis did have some merit. At the same time, from the board perspective, we needed to balance that with the fact that there is an awful lot of information usefulness in understanding what is happening over time and what is happening over product lines, and whether one product line is more profitable and another one less profitable, or whether there's in fact a situation in which one product line is completely cross-subsidizing another. We felt that provided very useful information for the users of financial statements about the possible future evolution of a particular in entity reporting in our standard. So we felt it was really important to balance these two processes. Now in June 2016, the board re-looked at this issue and proposed specific guidance that we felt was simpler guidance that we felt would be useful in terms of people applying the standard. But one of the concerns that arose during that process, the words that we used in that process was the word similar. And we used similar to describe profitability, and we used similar to describe risks. During the process of getting the feedback, during our field testing process, what we heard very clearly from the field testers was a couple of things. The first was that applying the test as we had written it, they arrived at a level of granularity that was considerably in excess of what the board had believed. So they arrived with a lot more groups than what we believed we had set out trying to achieve, and we thought that was really important. There was also an indication through that process that information usefulness declined based on the greater number of groups that came through the process. We heard that there were operational issues in applying the standard. And in particular, interestingly, we heard that the word similar was defined differently depending on circumstances. So when applying the word similar in the context of a qualitative measure like risk, companies were quite comfortable in the process of doing that. But when applying the word similar in a quantitative process, like the quantity of profit that you are going to recognize, companies struggle a lot more. And the consequence, as I say, was that there was a large number of groups that were bought for. Another thing we heard through the process was the idea of a bottom-up or top-down approach. Based on the wording that we had in the standard, insurance companies interpreted that they would need to start at the individual contract level and accumulate contracts into a group, whereas their current management process and their expected ongoing management process was that they started with an existing group, and they did not see it in the wording that we had that they could divide up or disaggregate that group into smaller subgroups. So in reconsidering this during our November board meeting, there were a couple of issues that the board then felt appropriate to amend. The first one, and it's on the slide in front of you, was to make it very clear for companies applying this standard, to make it clearer than it was previously was, that this determination of groups is an at-inception determination. You determine it on day one, and whatever contracts are determined to belong in a particular group remain in that particular group over the life of those contracts. So even if circumstances change after inception, you do not change the inception, the groups that you've determined at inception. The second was to deal with the idea of portfolio. The definition of portfolio has been around for a number of years in this standard, and it defines a portfolio as a group of contracts that are subject to similar risks. And by similar risks, we would argue that contracts like annuities and whole life don't have similar risks, but contracts that have similar risks are grouped together, and for portfolio perspective, they need to be managed together. So the starting point for the level of aggregation test now is that portfolio level. Contracts with similar risks managed together. And then we make it clear that an entity can either disaggregate from that level or start a separate process from the individual contract level and aggregate up. So you have the ability to take a top-down approach or a bottom-up approach depending on the circumstances of your particular systems. Having identified a portfolio, the next step that you take is to separate out those contracts within the portfolio that are onerous, and there are a number of indicators that you can consider for whether a contract is onerous, for example, differential pricing or other factors. Any contracts that are onerous are grouped separately, and the profit or loss or the loss is recognized immediately in profit or loss. Next, you divide the remainder of the contracts into that portfolio into two groups. The first of which is groups of contracts that have no significant risk of becoming onerous. These are contracts that, in a different terminology, we would consider as resilient, either because of a high level of profitability or because of a very low variation in risk expectations over the remaining life of the contract. So these are contracts that the entity does not expect will become onerous over their life. And then you've got the remaining contracts, whatever is left after you've made that division. By definition, these are contracts that are not resilient, that have a significant risk of becoming onerous. Important to note that we've defined two groups in the standard, but we don't require those specific two groups. So should an entity specifically believe that they can better do this with more groups than they are allowed to have more groups, 2, 3, 4, 5, but the two-group or the three-group process that's defined in the slide above is the minimum. But there's a second important thing to note. Not every group of contracts will have contracts that are onerous. Not every group of contracts will have contracts that are not resilient. So even though we've required you to determine three groups, you may well conclude, having determined those three groups, that some of the groups that you've determined are null groups. They have nothing actually in them. So we've now defined at the first instance how you work out these three groups on initial recognition, what the three groups are on initial recognition. The problem with this approach is what it allows to happen, and the concern that the board raised, is what we've termed everlasting buckets of CSM. So CSM that just lasts through the process. So the board added an additional grouping level, which is a cohort. A cohort comprises of contracts that are written within a single year. So contracts with, so having done the grouping in the previous two steps, you now consider that any contracts written within 12 months of each other can be grouped within those groups. But as soon as you move beyond the 12-month horizon, you have to start a new cohort, start a new group. We believe that element of annual cohorts, along with the requirement of coverage units, which reflect the expected duration and size of the contracts, would allow preparers to appropriately release the CSM over the expected life of the contract, the expected life of the group making up those contracts. We've brought back this slide. This is a slide that those of you who followed the various webinars that we've done will recognize from a previous one. It is unchanged. We've included in this presentation just to remind people, as we did on a previous occasion, that the decisions of the board are not overridden by the effect of regulation. So if a regulatory environment requires companies to put together or price similarly contracts that are in fact dissimilar, that are very different from each other, then the fact that that is a regulatory requirement does not override the previous requirement in the previous slide that you still have to split them out, that you have to group them into different groups. It is important to note, though, that because of the lower level of granularity that arises because of the changes in the decisions we made in November 2016, the effect of regulation is unlikely to be as significant as it would otherwise have been in an environment where there were a lot more groups.
The last webinar we presented in May and April was one about applying the standards for the first time. I'm just going to provide an update on one particular point that the board has decided on in November. When an entity is applying the standard for the first time, it needs to decide the transition by each group of contracts. The first port of call is the full retrospective approach, i.e. applying the standard as if it's always been in place since the contract was written. And an entity would need to decide if it could do so or if it is impracticable to do so. And the word impracticable and the guidance surrounding that is in IS 8. If it is impracticable, the board has provided a simplification. That simplification is that now an entity can decide either to use the modified retrospective approach or the fair value approach. Under the modified retrospective approach, the objective is to get to something similar to the full retrospective approach. So past information is still necessary to determine the contractual service margin. However, there are modifications available if necessary if the entity does not have reasonable and supportable information to determine the contractual service margin at inception of the contract and since then. In particular, for example, simplifications are given, for example, to determine the risk margin or the discount rate if the entity does not have information about the risk margin or the discount rate. Under the fair value approach, the entity will need to decide what is the fair value of the contract today that a market participant would be willing to take the contract off the books of the entity. The entity would need some past information to do the modified retrospective approach. In some cases, it might still be impracticable to apply the modified retrospective approach. In such cases, the entity would need to use the fair value approach. Thank you for listening to this update. If you would like further information about the project, we have some information available on the project page website. Thank you again for listening.